You're listening to West Virginia Morning. I'm John Cantese. Today marks 2 weeks since lawmakers left Charleston without approving a budget for the 2017 fiscal year that begins July 1st. Both the legislature and Governor Tomlin agreed they would return to the Capitol in the next few months to complete their work on the funding bill. But in the meantime, one group is making suggestions about what exactly lawmakers should do during that special budget session. Ted Bettner is the executive director of the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy, and he spoke with Ashton Mara about the 8 recommendations his group has for lawmakers.
Some of the things that we're trying to do is just sort of close a bunch of loopholes. So right now, if you go on your iPhone, for instance, and download a movie or rent a movie tonight, you're not going to pay a sales tax. But if you go down to Walmart or go down to any store and buy a DVD at Kroger, you're going to pay a sales tax. So we think we shouldn't be treating these companies where you buy things online differently than the mom and pop shops that are here in West Virginia. So expanding that tax to include digital downloads brings us about $10 million and makes our tax system much fairer. That's one idea. Another thing, too, is personal services. There's some things we don't tax. We don't apply a sales tax. It just doesn't make any sense. So if you go to a barber shop or you go to a beauty salon and get your hair cut or you go to a nail salon or a tattoo parlor, you don't pay a sales tax. And it just there's really no discernible reason for that other than there just happens to be a carve out. So if we can close some of those loopholes, that would help broaden the base and bring in some revenue. Those are two good examples.
There are a couple other specifics that I want to talk about, and one of them is the scaling back personal income tax exemptions. Basically, everybody in West Virginia gets a $2,000 tax exemption when they go to file their taxes. And you all are saying if a household has a joint income between $150,000 and $200,000 for that year, they should start phasing out the tax exemption for them. If that household makes more than $200,000, we should just get rid of that tax exemption. Why make that change?
Well, first of all, it's exactly what the federal government has done for a long time. They phase out the exemption. But you also have to look at over the last 30 years, who's really benefited largely from economic growth? Who's doing well? Well, it's mostly the people on the top. Most of the income gains over the last 30 or 40 years have gone to the top. Meanwhile, our personal income tax schedule has remained the same since 1987. Scaling that back a little bit on the people who are have the best ability to pay makes sense.
Well, two things here. You know, the first is the new Republican majority came in last year and they put together this tax commission to study the state's tax code. Mm-hmm. This was not a thing that ever came up in that study. But second, this also seems like a more complex change. Is it realistic to say they can come back in that special budget session for just a couple of days and we can get 134 people to understand this change to the tax code?
I think it would be fairly easy because this is what happens at the federal level if you're talking about the exemption. And I don't think it would be that very difficult for people to understand. The big part is to understand that it's progressive, too. All the tax proposals, the telecommunication tax, the tobacco tax, the expansion of sales taxes on other services, all take a larger chunk of income out of low and moderate income families than higher income families. So you have to look at the top, too. You have to understand, too, that when you're looking at the top and you're talking about raising taxes, it's much better to raise taxes on the top because those people tend to save their money and not spend it directly into the economy as much as middle class and lower income people.
Well, let's talk about two of those taxes that you just brought up, the increase to the tobacco tax and the sales tax on telecommunications services. This is basically a sales tax on cell phones or if you still have a landline, those kinds of things. And those were two tax increases that Governor Tomlin presented to lawmakers in January. You know, the tobacco tax was passed in the Senate. It failed in the House, I think in the House Finance Committee. Telecommunications tax didn't move in either chamber. So why recommend things that lawmakers don't seem willing to take on?
Well, I think if you poll it, that's the thing, especially the tobacco tax. This has overwhelming support. And because we don't have a high enough tobacco tax, it dramatically increases the health care cost and the things in our state budget, like the state's Medicaid program. The Medicaid program's $4 billion program. The state provides almost $1 billion of that. Large reason it's so expensive, too, is because we have a very unhealthy population. So it makes sense to help reduce health care costs and save lives by increasing tobacco tax to at a level that can do that. The problem was the governor's proposal was just not quite enough to really get people to stop smoking, especially teens. So that's why we were proposing to go with a full dollar like the Senate did. And I had very strong bipartisan support there. But we should also look at the flip side, too, to understand that this is a very regressive tax that falls on to especially low-income West Virginians. And one of the things that we've offered over the last couple of years as a way to deal with that that would have a dramatic impact is a refundable state earned income tax credit. About 26 states in this country have a state EITC modeled after the federal one. This would provide a huge work incentive to low-income families, especially single mothers. It would also help improve the upside-down tax system that we currently have with low- and middle-income people paying a higher share of their income in taxes than higher-income people.
Let's move on to the natural gas severance tax. The Senate this year approved a bill that initially would just decrease the severance tax on coal. They then amended the bill to decrease the severance tax on both coal and natural gas, claiming that both industries are struggling. With that in mind, you know that that at least one chamber of the legislature has said, we want to decrease these taxes. You all come in and say, we think you should increase them, at least for natural gas. So when you take these recommendations to lawmakers, how do you argue that point, knowing that a lot of them sit on the opposite side of the fence?
Well, if you go back to that time period in the Senate, if you remember, that was a very lot of political posturing going on it. They actually, I think, loved that bill to kill it. So saying that they actually wanted to decrease the natural gas severance tax, I'm not sure that that's what happened. I think what they did was they did that to make the fiscal impact so big that nobody would go forward with passing the bill in the House and put them in an awkward position. That's my guess. But when you do polling on the severance tax, it is one of the only popular taxes along with the tobacco tax. And there's a very good reason for that. You know, research shows that severance taxes have little impact on natural gas extraction and that the tax falls primarily on out-of-state customers and producers. It is the most progressive tax we have in West Virginia, and our inadequate taxation of it is one reason why West Virginia sort of is. People have said we sort of have a colonial economy where we've based our economy on the extraction of minerals.
So I want to talk about one thing that was not on your list of recommendations. The Senate Finance Chair, Mike Hall, has been very clear that the severance tax has been the base of West Virginia's tax income in the past, and that's not a stable revenue source. Senator Hall says the most stable tax revenue there is the food tax. And that's something that West Virginia decided to phase out. Why not recommend to lawmakers looking to something as stable as a food tax?
Well, you know, I think our state's worsening revenue situation isn't just entirely due to plunging energy prices. But the real problem in our situation, too, has been exacerbated by the impact of tax cuts that we've done in the past, two of them being the elimination of the business franchise tax and the decrease in the corporate net income tax from 9 to 6.5%. Both of those are at least $225 million in revenue we'd have this year but don't have. And the food tax you talked about is about $170 million in revenue. One of the problems is if you're on SNAP, for instance, at 130% of the poverty level below, you're not paying any sales tax. So if your concern with the food tax is that we shouldn't tax low-income people, if that's your concern, that is why it's not a very targeted tax cut. That's why we talked, a good bottom-up tax cut is a refundable state EITC to target those people directly, if that's our idea of where we want to get relief. You know, I think that is something that we could look at if it's paired with a bottom-up tax cut like a state EITC.
That was Ted Bednar with the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy speaking with Ashton Mara about what his group recommends lawmakers do to balance the state's budget. For more, you can visit our website, wvpublic.org. You're listening to West Virginia Morning at 7:53. Today's going to be mostly cloudy, and then gradually it's going to become a little sunnier later on. Highs will be in the 50s, and tonight the sky's going to be clear with lows in the 30s.
Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is provided by the law firm of Jenkins Fenstermaker, PLLC, representing businesses and individuals throughout West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, and Southeastern Ohio.
In Appalachia, barriers to health care include distance from a provider, lack of transportation, lack of health insurance, and the inability to take the time off work to drive, wait, and be seen. So throughout the region, mobile health units like the Health Wagon in southwestern Virginia are attempting to bridge that gap and bring services to some of the populations that need them the most, Carol Lofton reports.
Outside of an old train station in southwestern Virginia, Teresa Gardner and Paula Hill Mead are seeing patients.
What we're doing now is kind of reviewing a couple patients that came in this morning. And one gentleman has been in the recent coal mining layoffs.
That's Gardner, executive director of the Health Wagon, a mobile health unit that provides primary care to underserved Appalachian populations.
We're down to less than 100 coal mining jobs in Wise County. The coal mining industry has just been devastated. There used to be thousands of jobs in the area, and now it's reduced to less than 100.
Gardner said one family she'd seen that day had been able to get insurance through the Affordable Care Act, but that it was costing them more than $1,000 a month.
They were wanting to get established with us because they knew that they would not be able to continue affording that.
Paula Hill Mead is the clinical director of the Health Wagon. She said when they first started, they almost exclusively saw people without insurance.
But now we're seeing a lot of people with high co-deductibles that some $3,000-$4,000. So it's really catastrophic insurance because even the time you pay out $3,000-$4,000.
In 2013, the latest year for which data is available, the Health Wagon assisted more than 11,000 patients in 11 Southwest Virginia sites. These are often really sick people who either don't have insurance at all or can't afford the insurance they have.
There's not a day that goes by that patients' lives are not saved here in the clinic on a daily basis. We get them. They're train wrecks of patients. They came in with like more bunches of comorbid conditions.
Like diabetes, obesity, heart disease, or lung disease. One of those people is a young woman named Mary. We withheld her last name to protect her privacy. Like almost a million other Virginia residents, she doesn't currently have insurance, although she says she should get it in the next couple of months. She started using the Health Wagon about 6 months ago.
They've really helped me try to get my diabetes under control, which I wasn't aware that I had it, so I really don't know where I would be at in the last 6 months as far as health-wise. I'm probably in a lot worse shape than I am now.
The Health Wagon asks for a $10 donation from patients, if they have it. But services are usually offered for free. One of the reasons they are able to provide these services at a free or reduced cost to clients like Mary is that they closely collaborate with universities and organizations around the country, such as the University of Virginia Health System and the Virginia Healthcare Foundation. But also,
we are nurse practitioners, we are nurse managed, we work with schools throughout the nation, we work with pharmacy students, we work with physical therapy students, we work any way we can to try to develop collaboration to get our patients the best of care. So it's just not free care, it's quality care.
Again, that's Paula Hill Mead, the clinical director for the Health Wagon. She said they take a holistic, multidisciplinary approach to healthcare. Partnerships with labs, pharmacy schools, and universities allow them to provide specialty consults through telemedicine services and tests at free or reduced cost. The vast majority of the population that uses their services are working poor adults. Most of the children in the area qualify for Medicaid. Teresa Gardner explains another reason for the Health Wagon's aim to offer services for free or at reduced costs.
We're trying to address these, you know, healthcare disparities because we have higher rates of about every disease process, and we have higher rates of diabetes, we have higher rates of mental illness, suicide, we have higher.
According to the Health Wagon website, compared with the rest of Virginia, Health Wagon clients are 21% more likely to die from diseases of the heart, are 14% more likely to die from diabetes, are 40% more likely to die from unintentional injuries, and are 50% more likely to die from suicide.
You know, the economy is just really kind of devastated here. I've been here in this clinic for 23 years, and I have never seen it this dire for these patients. They have to make daily choices between, you know, eating and paying electricity bill or, you know, medications and so forth like that. We see that on a daily basis. And unfortunately, people die without, you know, health care access because of the economic factors that are, you know, that play into that.
This year, in part due to the coal mining layoffs, they've had a wait list for services. The Health Wagon just added a new nurse practitioner to try and meet the demand. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Carol Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, with support from the Benedum Foundation.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with all of the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. And we're interested in your comments, so make sure you send them to feedback@wvpublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at WV Public News and find us on Facebook. Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting's news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director is Teresa Wills. And I'm John Cantese. Have a good morning.